Reva Steenkamp was Oscar Pistorius's girlfriend. At some point, she's in the bathroom and he ends up shooting through the bathroom door.
I think it's very interesting that someone like you, using science, can really make a jury see the other side.
And they claimed that they heard a woman screaming and arguing, and then heard gunshots, and then heard more screaming and arguing, and heard more gunshots.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds and executive producer of Fox's new America's Most Wanted. With me today is...
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor and senior producer on Fox's America's Most Wanted. Jim, I mean, we are back with one of our most exciting guests ever, in my opinion.
Of course.
And his name is...
Scott Roeder, evidence specialist, evidence room, Cleveland, Ohio, USA, and forensic animation entrepreneur.
Awesome.
Wow.
Not too many people
can
say those things. Right.
I was going to go in the master of disaster, the king of sting, the sultan of SWAT.
What is happening?
It's a Muhammad Ali thing.
I don't know, but I love it. Yeah.
I can't help it that I'm so pretty.
Yeah,
I need more titles.
I know.
I need a lot more titles. But
what's amazing about Muhammad Ali, you know, as I lived through his sort of battle with Joe Frazier, I always liked Joe Frazier because he was the quiet one, the understated hero, the underdog, really. And I thought just Ali was just this loudmouth with all these publicists and all this other stuff. And then later on in life, I realized he actually did all that himself. He was his own publicist. He was his own writer. He was his own everything. And he had one thing that really struck me was, I think it was talking about the Thriller in Manila or something like that, where he said, they clocked my punch at 400ths of a second. And he said, that's, if you break a second into 100 little pieces, it's only four of them. And the fact that he felt he had to explain what 100th of a second is told me that he probably just learned it, you know? And so to me, somebody who was able to come from that basic understanding and make himself literally the greatest that ever lived, right? That is an amazing accomplishment to have done himself.
Well, willed it into existence.
Yes.
That's what I think of Muhammad Ali. He willed himself to be great. And I admire that self-love to will yourself into greatness.
Well, speaking of great, I think that Scott Roeder's career and what he does with forensic animation, Jim, is great. And I can't wait to dive right back into this story of his trip to South Africa and his, you know, experience dealing with a case that the whole world was watching.
Couple things just to catch up our listeners, because this is, you know, sort of a well-known case. But Reva Steenkamp was Oscar Pistorius's girlfriend. They were sleeping in the same bed. And fast forward, at some point, she's in the bathroom and he ends up shooting through the bathroom door. And she is on the other side of that door and she is killed.
The prosecution's case relied upon some ear witness testimony from somebody at 1 o'clock in the morning, 500 yards away as the crow flies, who was sitting out on their balcony having tea or whatever, at 1 o'clock in the morning. And they claimed that they heard a woman screaming and arguing, and then heard gunshots, and then heard more screaming and arguing, and heard more gunshots.
What physical evidence was there that the prosecution relied upon to think he was on his prosthetics? And why was that important in the case?
Well, the prosecution relied upon bad information and some incompetence by their own staff and their own ability to understand a crime scene reconstruction. Yeah.
I don't think there is any question that he was not on his blades, that he was on his drugs. I don't think that was a question at all, because the forensic
trial
showed the angle. Right.
Yeah.
I think they showed the angle of entry into that doorway. You found stippling at the corner, so that gives you an idea of where he was shooting from. That's not debatable unless he moved. There was two locations of the shooting. And I don't know if you can prove that all four shots came from one location, but either way, there were four shots that went through the door. So we know exactly the angle that they were shot at. And if he was at 6'2", the gun would be at a certain height or lower.
Like around 4 feet, 4.5 feet, something like that.
So Scott, you know, the prosecution presented one side, you put together this forensic animation that you now shared with us. Amazing stuff. You know, tell our listeners and viewers what is the end result of what you did in this particular case?
Well, I think at the end of the day, we were able to demonstrate in a very scientific manner a very extraordinary circumstance of just this terrible tragedy and mix up of who this person, Oscar, thought he was shooting at. And in my opinion, after review of the physical and forensic evidence, I believe it unfolded like this. Oscar wakes up in the middle of the night to bring in these fans and then closes these blackout curtains. He then puts a pair of jeans over this LED light over the top of his radio. And while he was doing that, we timed it out at about 23 seconds. That was enough time for Reva to get up out of bed, walk down the hallway, and go into the bathroom. As she was going into the bathroom, she opened up a window that opened with a screeching sound. This alerted Oscar to go retrieve his handgun from the side dresser of the bed, and while walking on his stumps, goes down the corridor screaming, "Reva, somebody's in the house. Reva, I think somebody's in the house." As he's getting closer to the door, I can only imagine Reva hearing Oscar scream, "Reva, somebody's in the house." She then retreats into the toilet room for fear of this unknown person that is in the house. But what really is, Oscar's coming toward her, hearing her, thinking she's the threat. She's reacting as if there's a threat that she can't see. So she retreats into the toilet. And then in this tragic situation, he posts up against the wall on his stumps. She makes a movement inside of the toilet room that jars him. And he, at this heightened state of excited and adrenaline, shoots four shots just off of horizontal into the bathroom through the door, striking her, I think, mistakenly. And then after that, he realizes, holy shit, I think maybe where's Reva? And he just tries to find Reva. He can't find Reva. She must be the one in the door. So he goes out to the balcony and he's on his stump still and he's screaming on the balcony, "Reva, help, help, call the police, help, help." And when he screams, he's got this very high-pitched sound. He screams like that of a girl. And that corresponds with a witness that heard a woman screaming for help when really it was Oscar after the shooting. Then he puts on his prosthetic legs, grabs his cricket bat, and goes into the bathroom and starts slamming the cricket bat onto the bathroom door that he just shot through the holes through because he wants to save Reva now because the door was locked from the inside. That sound of the cricket bat slamming through that door from 500 yards away, and I did an experiment, you'll see it on the video, sounds just like somebody shooting through a wood door if you don't know what you're listening for. And then he's able to get her out, picks her up, he carries her downstairs and rests her on the floor where she's met by the ambulance and so forth. And I believe that my reconstruction is consistent with the physical and the forensic evidence on that case. And this is the version of the events that Oscar gave the police the night that it happened. And I don't believe that an excited utterance like that, without time to premeditate the story to match the evidence, is actually true, because I tested it, you'll see it, and I believe today still, Oscar didn't think he was shooting at Reva. He thought he was shooting at an intruder. And that's my side of the story.
Well, and I mean, that's just fascinating, because obviously the prosecution felt very differently, and that's why they prosecuted the defendant for all of this. Can you just remind our listeners and our Patreon subscribers what happened? What was the result in the case?
Well, I believe that the result of the trial judges was correct in that he was found guilty of what they call culpable homicide, which is essentially reckless manslaughter here in state's terms. And they sentenced him to 5 years house arrest. That was the result of the trial itself. Now, this isn't the United States, and they do not have double jeopardy. So the government actually appealed that verdict and sentencing, and on appeal, without any further testimony, overruled that verdict and upgraded it to homicide and sentenced him to 10 years in a medical facility. And that ultimately was his fate. But I believe that the trial judge was correct. But then in an odd twist of justice, like I said, this isn't America. There's no such thing as double jeopardy. You can't try somebody twice in this country, but there you can. And on appeal, he lost badly.
So, Scott, we've seen the video now of your forensic reconstruction, your forensic animation reconstruction of this crime. And certainly it's compelling. It's very interesting. It's very incredibly well conceived and shot. And I, as a behavioralist, feel that there are the only place that I differ, and I love the fact that you base this on forensic science. You actually went to the site, you had the door reset so that you could actually make the angle measurements and do the strings that show the trajectory of the bullets and all that. So I think that's all really good. That helps me in my behavioral reconstruction, which is I am very experienced in forensics. Not only did I study physics and chemistry in college, but I became an evidence person on the evidence response team in the FBI for 8.5 years. And then I became a profiler and focused mainly on behavior, but of course relied extremely heavily on forensic evidence during that entire time. So I love this, and I would love to, even after this, sit down with you and go through the video in detail, because to me, there are some questionable aspects of it. And, you know, obviously, the background, the relationship between Reva and Oscar at the time, and the breakups that had occurred, and the text messages that had gone back and forth and things like that. I know that it came out during trial. I don't know if it was admitted as evidence, but a previous incident in which I believe Oscar fired a weapon out of the car when they were in public. So, you know, those were things that sort of are background to the behavior that happened on this particular day. And then the whole issue of the fans. So for our fans and listeners and viewers, it's pretty hot in South Africa at this time of year. And even though it's February, which we experience in North America as cold, it's actually very hot there in South Africa. That's the middle of their summer, right? So
yes,
he didn't use air conditioning, but he had these fans, and they were sort of in a stacked arrangement, and they were out on the balcony just outside of his bedroom, right? And that was there were these dark blackout curtains between the room, the glass doors, and where the fans are. It's my understanding that he went out to the deck and brought those fans in. So they were either just outside the bedroom or just inside the bedroom.
Right at the threshold.
Okay, so the glass doors were open?
The glass doors were open and fixed to either side of the wide fan so that the almost like the glass door was that the fan was directly up against the glass door on either side.
And that's on sandwich. Purpose, sucking in cooler air or putting out hotter air, whichever way it was facing.
Well, what they were trying to do was just get circulation.
Right.
But because you have those in, didn't want them like that all night long, because I don't know if you've ever been to Africa. There are bugs as big as my head that crawl around and fly around.
Stop.
You don't want those windows open. Well, you don't want those windows open all night long. You're going to have centipedes crawling out of your playing pinochle on your snout. So you want to close those screens and those doors at some point when the night gets cold enough to sleep without air conditioning.
Right. So, you know, my question would be at that point, you know, the drapes are open. They're not blacking out the room anymore. Even though there's a fan or two fans actually stacked and in sort of an opening of these drapes, there is some ambient light that's going to seep through there.
Well, I'll disagree with you there forensically, because that was a big part of the reconstruction that we did, because Oscar did say, and you'll see in the reconstruction, that after he brings the fans in, he closes the doors, shuts the drapes tight, and then the fans are now inside the room. So now it's pitch black. There's zero ambient light coming in from the dark Africa sky.
But what I'm talking about is not after he's closed them. What I'm talking about is during the process. Wasn't she already out of the bed at the time that he did that?
We don't believe so. We believe that she got up out of the bed at the time. It took him approximately 20 seconds to get up out of his side of the bed, walk around the front of the bed, bring the fans in, close the doors, close the drapes. And then that's when he heard the sound. That was about 20 seconds. And that was plenty of time for her to get up and go to the bathroom without being noticed, seen, heard, or sensed.
But if you're saying that, so he turned off the fans or he left the fans on?
The fans continued to be on, but now just inside of the room.
And so the period of time where does he move the fans to?
Just slightly inside of the threshold, and maybe 6 inches toward him.
And that, I just don't understand how that doesn't suck in the material from the curtains if they're six inches.
Well, these curtains are probably weigh 100 pounds a piece.
Blackout curtains are very heavy, so that they don't move.
Yeah, I think there's even sand in the bottom of the curtains. But the fans were far enough away from the curtains. And now, mind you, you'll see this also in the reconstruction. I was there in that room at 1 o'clock in the morning with the exact fans, with the exact curtains, with the exact drapes and everything. And I did that test and it was scary how dark it was. It took several minutes for me to adjust my eye to just even sense 5 feet in front of me. It was very dark, I will personally attest.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, if you're already in the darkness and you've just woken up, your eyes are already adjusted to the darkness.
Well, but as you mentioned earlier, he's going from the ambient light that's coming in from the outside to total blackout. So
this would
be nearly blackout.
So you're saying his story is that during that entire time, he did not look back towards the bed at all. Like he was only facing outside.
Right. Well, because he has to have balance, right? So he's walking on a stump. So he's literally taking a fan like.
For our listeners, Scott is demonstrating moving a fan.
Right. Yeah. What I'm saying is doing that while balancing on your stumps, you're facing the fan. The fan is in your face and it's pitch black now and you have noise. And then behind you, on a $3,000 bed, which is on a 5-inch marble floor, which has a 1-inch carpeting, you couldn't hear an elephant get up out of the bed and walk down that hallway.
What's a 5-inch marble floor? I'm sorry, I don't know what you mean.
I'm talking about a marble floor. This is not a wood floor. Like, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. When I snuck out of my bed at night and I get out of my bed, creak, creak, right. creak, right? It's a house built in the 30s, right?
Right.
This is a brand new condo built with marble floors. You will not hear a creak or a sound or a footstep, not from a girl, not from a dog, not from an elephant. This was a very the solid, kind of environment. Right. Yeah, right. That's what I'm telling okay. you. It's a yeah, marble floor with thick carpeting.
Okay.
Interesting, and, Jim. Can I just say, for me as a former prosecutor, what really strikes me about this is that I had an overall impression of this case from the media coverage and what we heard about the trial as it was going on and then the verdict and what happened afterward. You know, and it seemed fairly clear to me that he murdered his girlfriend, that it was basically a domestic violence situation. It seemed pretty clear to me. Now I'm not so clear. I mean, I think it's very interesting that someone like you, with the specialty that you have using science, can really make a jury see the other side in a way that having a trial without you might not. You know, that makes you extremely valuable to whichever side uses you. But that kind of reconstruction, that kind of animation, that those sort of explanations are really interesting. And Jim, I think it's one of the things that I would have said I faced certainly as a state prosecutor when I was an ADA. I didn't have any money for an animation reconstruction right. of any kind. Mm-hmm. No way.
Yeah.
But defendants right. did. And so sometimes that makes the difference. And so I find it very interesting that even for someone like me, whose sympathies are almost always with the prosecution, you have me wondering, and now I just want to go back. I want to look at your video and I want to go back and really look at facts. It's very interesting how you.
And I'd like to add just one thing, Francie, and it would be this. People ask me all the time, is Oscar Pistorius guilty or not guilty? And I say this.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
He's not guilty. Now, I'm not saying that he's innocent. I'm saying that he's not guilty based on the standard that I understand that I use under, the Thomas Jefferson letter, 1,000 guilty men go free, lest one innocent man be put in jail. Under that standard, the beyond a reasonable doubt, he's not guilty. And I base that based not on my like or my liking him or my sympathy for any side or the other. I don't know these people. I don't know my friends with them. But I think in the realm of probability, yes, he's not guilty. And that's where I feel very comfortable scientifically saying that.
Yeah. And that, I totally understand why you say that. And I know that this was it's a hotly contested case.
Yes.
And I base my opinions on it based on only what I've heard in the news and the coverage I watched of the trial and literally watching his behavior when he testified and when he made demonstrations and so forth. And yeah. And I will say that I know you said that he, you know, he screams in a very high pitched voice, and I don't dispute that because we heard him scream in a very high pitched voice. But I also believe at the end of the day that was all theater. That he actually, every time he was asked a question in which he had to recount something like that, he always got himself very upset, and so that it would set the stage for him to be screaming at a very high pitched voice. I will tell you this. I don't know another man on the planet who raises his voice to a higher octave in order to scare a threat. I believe that men do the opposite, and I don't believe that it's natural to go to a much higher octave than your speaking voice in order to try to threaten a threat that has invaded your house. So those are the things that I base it on.
What I want to add to that, Jim, is one, I think that your observations with regard to the demeanor and nature of the delivery of his testimony in court was not reasonable. When I was watching him testify, I was cringing and my stomach was turning sideways because that's not how he recounted the story to me when everything was calm and I was walking him through it from an evidentiary standpoint after I had already done my reconstruction. And I kind of gave him an opportunity of, here's how I think you should testify. We're going to walk you through it. We're going to be unemotional. We're going to look at it from a standpoint and just try to keep it together. Whereas I feel like the advice that he got, not from me, but from other advisors, was to play up the whole sympathy thing. And I think it totally backfired. It made him look not credible on the stand. And I was uncomfortable with the manner of his testimony because that's not how he acted when he was telling me.
Okay, I know.
And I didn't agree with it. So I agree with you.
Yeah. So, and you know, I readily admit that I didn't get to go to the scene and I didn't get to actually interview him. I would have loved those opportunities. I would love to still do it today. And maybe we can do that. And that's another episode we could do together. But the fact is that I agree that you were in a position to assess a number of things that I was not in a position to do. So I'm only basing this on the evidence that I have. And every time we do a behavioral analysis, we only base it on the evidence that we have. And we usually put a disclaimer at the top saying, this is based on the evidence we have. So
right.
But I love that you were there and you can supply me with the forensics. And you've supplied us with the forensics. And I believe you said that the prosecution eventually stipulated that your forensic findings were actually accurate. And that sort of undermined a lot of their theory of the case. Now, the theory of the case doesn't necessarily mean that's actually what happened. But it's a theory that the prosecution comes up with to sort of connect all the evidence that they have together. So I don't think our opinions are that far apart.
No, they're not.
They're shades of difference. And I think that you know, what actually happened, I don't understand completely the South African law that allows the Court of Appeals to upgrade the charges.
There's no jury system there. It's a three judge panel, mm-hmm. and it's a different three judge panel on appeal. So imagine, you know, you're found, you know, guilty of manslaughter, and then on appeal, the government gets to upgrade it to murder. It didn't sit very well with me.
That doesn't work, right? That doesn't work here. I believe what actually happened there was the Court of Appeals found that based on the evidence that was presented at the trial, that the findings should have been murder versus basically criminally negligent homicide. Right. That's what it would be here. So I don't think there's any doubt that, you know, look, he admitted that he pulled the trigger, that he killed his girlfriend. He says it was because he was afraid that somebody else was in there and that he thought he was protecting his girlfriend and himself. And you know, and we may never know unless, you know, some, you know, revelations happen that we don't have today. Which,
well, but Jim, you know, as you know, in the law, but both here and in many countries, if you cause someone's death, whether you meant to or not, with whatever your intent or not, there are still legal consequences. And certainly he's facing those. So I want to ask you, Scott, our big question, our famous question that we ask all our guests, was this a best case or a worst case for you and why?
Well, I think it was a best case. I mean, you know, whenever anybody interviews me, this is kind of like my Stairway to Heaven song, you know. But although I've got a lot of great hits, but this is the one everybody always wants me to sing. And it's really given me an opportunity to share the discipline of forensic animation with the world. And now I work internationally on reconstructing homicides. And it's really given me an opportunity to bring this discipline, which was spawned here on the mean streets of Cleveland, Ohio, and I get to bring it to different corners of the earth.
Another title for you, Francie.
That's right.
The mean streets of Cleveland, Ohio. There you go.
That's right.
That could be a lot of things. That could be a Cleveland Browns podcast.
It could be. Oh, yeah. Go Browns, baby.
Well, really appreciate you coming and putting up with me. And
I had a blast. I had a blast. Jim, I would love to have you as my lab partner to just be the skeptic in my laboratory.
All of us need that.
He's your Moriarty. We've already discussed
it. No, I'm not.
My Moriarty. Jim is your Moriarty.
No.
He might think it's the other way.
Well, let's be honest. It's kind of accurate, Jim, because Moriarty was an evil genius. And hello?
I'm not.
What?
I'm not evil.
You're not a genius? What?
No, but Scott, you're absolutely right. We all need that. We all need the skeptics. Yeah. And that's why profiling and behavioral analysis should be done not as an individual, but as a group, because you need the benefit of other people's perspectives and their questions and their challenges. And
absolutely.
I see this in you, and I love it as well. When you have to defend your position, when you have to explain and give the details, it actually helps you decide, you know, do I really believe this or is there a doubt? And you learn the process, and you can actually elevate the level of belief you have and also the ability to actually defend it because people have given you these challenges. And
absolutely. Yeah.
And I would say
amazing insight, Jim. Fantastic. Yeah. I love it.
And the other thing is, I recognize in you something that I discovered in myself when I was testifying as an expert, that you become sort of hyper alert, and you get very quippy with those lawyers who are cross examining you, and the jury loves it because they love the little things, like you said. Yeah, and I don't have a paper route, so I do this full time. So I'm sure the jury laughed, right? I mean, because whenever you can get the jury to laugh in a murder case, that tells you that they are on your side, because they won't laugh if they are totally against you. So I think that's a really cool tool that you have, that your brain probably kicks into hyperdrive when somebody challenges you. So that's a cool thing.
It's a natural competitiveness, I think, that comes out of me. I'm a baseball player. I've been a baseball player. Both of my kids played baseball. My son played a little bit of pro baseball. I still play old man baseball. And it's like kind of that nervousness, the butterflies in your stomach when you step into the batter's box and you got a 25-year-old kid throwing an 85-mile-an-hour fastball, and you're hoping it doesn't go in your ear, you know, because you wink at him, you know. And it's that same thing when you get on the stand, you get those butterflies and you're wondering, hey, is this Harvard-educated prosecutor going to kick my ass, or am I going to give him his lunch? And there's a competitiveness when it comes to the work that I do, because it's personal, because, you know, if you attack me, you're attacking my profession and what I've spent my life doing.
Ultimately, it's your reputation. And wow, this has been a great episode, or couple of episodes, really, of Best Case, Worst Case. And Scott, just thank you so much for joining us. It's been a blast. I hope you'll come back and come back a lot.
Thank you so much. I would love to.
Also, y'all, you can check out Scott Roeder's Evidence Room podcast anywhere you listen to your favorite podcasts. So be sure to check out Evidence Room.
That's awesome. Well, thank you. And for now, we're signing off. from Best Case, Worst Case. Thank you for listening and watching.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production produced by Francie Hakes, Josh Murphy, and Jim Clementi at Empire Studios LA. Engineered and edited by Matt Gerbel. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba and hosted by Wondery.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness Delight can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's d2l.org.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.